Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw and I am really excited. This is a special show because it's really something that is near and dear to my heart that I've thought for a long time we need to talk more about. And we're finally doing it and I've got some amazing guests to talk about it. And that is the Society for Education and Anesthesia. I really have made education a central part of my career, and C being the Society for Education and Anesthesia has really been a part of that the whole way. It's given me so much. I'm so grateful to the organization and the people I've met through it. And people come to me all the time and ask, how can I get more involved in education and anesthesia? This is what I want to do. And I'm always surprised they haven't heard about C. So we are going to talk about C with some amazing people today, and you're going to get to learn more about it and how you can get involved if you want. And so I have with me first Dr. Franklin Claddis, who's a professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine and is anesthesiologist in chief at UPMC Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He's also the president-elect of the organization. That's the Society for Education and Anesthesia. He's been a member since 2003. I also have Dr. Meredith Kingeter. She is an assistant professor of anesthesiology. She practices both cardiac and liver anesthesia, and she's the associate program director of the residency program at Vanderbilt. And she's been a C member since 2017, and she's the chair of the membership committee. And I have Dr. Bridget Mariquin, who is an associate professor of anesthesiology at the University of North Carolina Hospitals. She arrived in North Carolina only just last fall after 10 years at the University of Vermont, where she was vice chair for education and the associate residency program director. And she completed a master's in health professions education more recently in 2022. So all people really interested in education who have been members of and really feel strongly about their connection to C, as am I. And we're going to talk about it today. So to the three of you, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's start with just a little overview. Kind of, I gave a little intro, but tell us a little more about who you are and what you do in your everyday. And Meredith, let's start with you.
All right. So as you mentioned, I split my time between cardiac and liver. We're a pretty busy center here at Vanderbilt. And so those two pods certainly keep me on my toes clinically. And then when I'm not clinical, I am our associate PD for the core residency. And so I've been in that role for almost four years and have enjoyed it. I trained at Vanderbilt, and so it's really special to be a part of the education office where I, you know, got my feet under me. It's been a lot of fun.
Fabulous. All right. Mm-hmm. Bridget, how about you?
So, as you mentioned in my intro, new to UNC, my roles at UVM, heavy education. So, you know, 20-30% of my time was assisting our program director, developing CME, coordinating med student rotations, such like that. And I was recruited to UNC to help start an AA school. And my husband took a job down here as well. So, It seemed like the right time to leave UVM. The AA school is yet to happen. Maybe that could be another future podcast. We could talk about anesthesia assistants and their roles in perioperative medicine. I think there's certainly a growing need. We would all agree in our workforce shortage. So it's in a way been refreshing. I trained at UNC, so it's nice to be back, but also I was a little nervous to give up all the titles and all the, you know, responsibilities I've had, but it's fun to be the new girl and just be busy in the clinical arena and experience, you know, resident learning, teaching just at that ground level. So I do about 75% of my stuff is just general OR, you know, outpatient neuro things. And then 25% of what I do is OB anesthesia. And that's sort of my clinical niche, my clinical passion.
Fabulous. And am I correct that you did an OBGYN residency?
I did. And I actually practiced for 4 years in rural North Carolina. And I didn't love the business of medicine. And malpractice was really stressful. Just the idea of having to pay the big chunk of money every month into malpractice, and just felt like I was just struggling. I was drowning. And I considered even just giving up medicine altogether. I have a very supportive husband who said, "Is the blood, sweat, and tears we put into what we do, I want you to be happy." So we considered fellowships. None of them really appealed to me. And he said, "What did you like in med school?" And I said, "I liked the anesthesia." So we lived here at the time. I talked to some people at Duke, some people at UNC. They said, "No, you're not crazy." apply and let's see what happens. So thankfully I had a lot of great mentors and a really supportive husband. So I found anesthesia, not that I would have planned it or I would have thought that was my future when I was a med student, but here I am.
Very cool. Well, when I was a resident, we had an OB anesthesia attending, Jen Lucero, who same thing. She'd done an OBGYN residency, was practicing, went back and did anesthesia, did an OB fellowship and practiced OB anesthesia. And it was so cool to have that perspective as someone who kind of knew both sides of it. Very, very cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Franklin, how about you?
I was going to say, Bridget, you're the embodiment of the lifelong learner. You truly, seriously, you're this continuous metamorphosis as you go through your clinical and educational career. It's fascinating. Right. That's actually the beauty of education. So it's funny, I think, but a lot of people have that experience. I had a little bit of that experience after med school. I was like, I'm going to be an anesthesia intensivist. In fact, I was super excited about Hopkins years ago. This is in the 1990s. And I ran into Ron Lippman. Ron Lippman got me excited about peds anesthesia, which felt kind of funny for me because I'd done 3 years of medicine, internal medicine, then 3 years of anesthesia. And I thought, peds, am I really going to do peds? But I thought, you know what? I could do this for 30 years. So I hopped into peds. And in 2003, came to Pittsburgh, and I've never left. Because Pittsburgh, for me, was great. Because as soon as I got here, I asked Peter Davis, our chief, to be the associate program director of the fellowship, because he didn't have one. And from there, I did that for 3 years, and then became the program director in 2006, and did that for 18 years. So I was at PD for a long time. And a lot of it was because it was fun. It was the whole experience of education and helping people in their development and growing and launching. They kind of feel like a parent in some ways. And what's so cool is to see them now at meetings and their chiefs and chairs and PDs, and they're doing some amazing stuff. And then in my career, I thought, I will never be a chief or a chair. That is so not who I am. But as you realize, as you go through this process of helping people to develop, you realize actually being a division chief or a chair, it's about development. So as a program director, you're developing our trainees, but as a chair or chief, you're developing programs and faculty. So it's kind of the same thing in some ways, but just a little bit different, a little more headache because you have administrative, you know, the overhead, which is kind of crazy. My clinical work is with pediatrics, but I'm on the acute pain service. So I do acute pain, lots of regional blocks, and I do some pediatric chronic pain, and I'm on the pediatric liver transplant team. So that's my kind of clinical bent. And as far as just like research bent, I'm not a huge researcher, but the stuff I really love now is more of the organizational behavior, social psychology stuff, which is the whole concept of psychological safety and its impact on patient care, patient safety, medical education, and DEI. Oh, that's a bad word. But I mean, that is the whole concept of like, how do we bring all that stuff back?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And we share a love of dark chocolate. We've discovered over the years. And so
we do.
If anyone's listening,
high quality dark chocolate.
Yes. High quality dark chocolate. If anyone is listening who has great high quality dark chocolate that they love, tell us what it is or send some to us and we would love to try it. All right. So, and folks probably who are listening know me, but I'll just briefly say in case you're tuning in for the first time, that I have been, in anesthesia since I finished, residency in 2014, did an ICU fellowship, and then have done a few things. I split my clinical time between the surgical ICUs and the general ORs, and then I run the residency program at Hopkins, and I do about half my time clinical and half non-clinical in that role. And then in addition to running the residency, I also help run the anesthesia and the ICU clerkships. So it's a really nice balance, and I love it. Let's talk about C, which again is the Society for Education in Anesthesia. We're all members. We all feel pretty strongly about it. So I'd like to hear from each of you when you first joined and kind of what your experience and roles have been in the organization. Meredith, you're the most junior, so let's start with you.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. I had never heard of this society, and I was fortunate enough to have two mentors at Vanderbilt when I became an attending tell me you should become a member of the society. And so I was a passive member starting in 2017 when I graduated residency. And then it was actually in 2022 that I went to C's workshop on teaching, which is actually where I met Bridget. And I'll forever be thankful for this mentorship session. I mean, it was a great workshop, highly recommend for anyone interested. But at the end of the workshop, we were just sitting around a table talking. And I said, how do I get more involved in, you know, education, leadership? How do I build a career doing this? And I knew I wanted to, you know, be in academics. I wasn't yet in the education office leadership. And they said, you know, become an active member, join committees, start going to meetings, start networking. And I did that. My first meeting was spring in 2022 and sat down at the membership committee table and was so appreciative of the kindness that was shown to me in the society. And no slight to ASA by any means, but I felt like I had just found a group of like-minded individuals who were passionate about the same things that I was. And, you know, they wanted to know about me. They introduced themselves. They were, you know, welcoming. They were encouraging my input on how to make the society better, how to, you know, make education better. And it was just the most amount of fun I could have ever had. And that was my first meeting before knowing anyone. And then it's just grown from there. Yeah. And so, yeah, here we are 3 years later.
Yeah. And I'll say a couple of things you brought up that I think are really key. One is the barrier to entry is so low. You go to a C meeting and you don't have to apply and go through a prolonged process and get letters of recommendation to join a committee. You just sit down at a table and boom, you're in the committee. And it's really nice because for young folks, whether you're a resident or whether you're a new attending or whether you're, and by the way, this society is of course open to all interested in education. You could be a new AA, you could be a new CRNA, and you're sitting down and you want to just join. You don't have to worry about a prolonged process. And then you start getting engaged right away. So I think that process is fabulous about C. And then, as you said, it's a smaller organization. So unlike the, you know, 15,000 person conference at ASA, you really engage with a small group who you're going to see again and again. And we've had a ton of fun at the meetings, as you said. Great. Bridget, you're kind of, you and I are more in the middle range of our careers and how long careers. We've been doing this. So how about you? What's your story with C?
My story. So my first job out as an attending was at the University of Rochester in Denham Ward, longstanding SCA member, FAIR president, right? He was my chair. And as a new faculty member, you think, oh, I don't know how to teach in the OR. I don't know how to give a presentation. How do I give feedback? So like most academic medical centers, there was a collection of academicians, faculty across the medical school. And so they had afternoon faculty development workshops. And so if I was expected to get out of the OR around 4 or 5, I'd sign up and I'd go to these faculty development workshops. And then lo and behold, about a year and a half later, Denham Ward called me in his office and he said, so we keep track of who goes to these faculty development workshops at the College of Medicine. And he said, you've gone to more than any other faculty member for the past year. So I'm going to send you to the SEA workshop on teaching. Once again, I didn't know what the SCA was. I didn't know what the workshop and teaching was. But in 2012, I showed up in Lexington, Kentucky, and I met some, you know, amazing C educators, Melissa Davidson, Dave Kamadian, Tom McClarney, Gary Lloyd. And to reiterate what Meredith said, I just felt like I found my people. I was just so energized and this is all new, but I feel as though I can go and do it back at my home institution. And so I did go back and started, you know, instituting some new things about, you know, how do I write learning objectives? Okay, let's write appropriate learning objectives. And how do I give feedback? And then after about 2 or 3 years, I felt like I needed a refresher. And now I had some you know, content to take back with me and sort of create some, you know, some new frameworks. And so I went back again and all the same people were there and met some new faculty across the country and you collaborate, you network. And then fast forward about a year or two, I find myself at the University of Vermont. And lo and behold, who's there but Melissa Davidson, who's only been there a year. And so we're sort of the new people trying to fit in this sort of new academic environment. And she recognized me from the workshop on teaching and took me under her wing as a mentor And we did a couple of faculty workshops locally at University of Vermont. And she said, oh, let's take this to the SCA. And so I think our first workshop at the SCA was in 2016 or 17. It was a workshop on workshops. So like how to deliver, you know, an effective workshop. And then she really has mentored me and helped me launch from there. And so now I'm a C workshop faculty. And on the committee for research, the research committee. And I too just love connecting with people, and you meet these really big names who are amazing educators and researchers in their field, and you know, you sit down and you have breakfast or coffee with them, and they're so engaging and collaborative, and they want you to succeed as much as they want themselves to, or maybe even more so, I think, in some instances. So that's my C journey.
Yeah, fabulous. Thank you. And I'll say, you pointed out a couple important things. So the workshop on C offers a few things, right? So the two main meetings every year that C has are one in the fall and in November, which is right before the program director meeting, which makes sense. And it's in Chicago, right along, at least for now, it's along with the program director meeting the day before. And then in the spring, a longer meeting. That fall meeting is a one-day meeting. In the spring is a kind of 2.5-day meeting, which is in a different place every spring. And both are fabulous. And then they also offer a workshop on teaching, which Meredith and Bridget, both of you mentioned that you've been a part of, which I have not done, so I can't speak to the specifics, but I think it probably is relatively self-explanatory, which is kind of getting some good teaching on how to be a great teacher. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Absolutely.
Yes, like very basic pedagogy, learning objectives, learning styles, cognitive overload. And the other really great thing, I think, is it's a very small meeting. So the participants, we max them out at about 40, and the faculty 6 to 8. And Meredith, I think, would agree, it's an intense 4 days. You are exhausted and exhilarated at the same time at the end of those 4 days.
Great. Well, before we get to Franklin, who's in the more senior end of his time, I'll just say kind of my path. So and this is something we're hearing echoed again and again, right, is that so much of this, and this is a great lesson just in general, is about having an interested mentor who gives you a push. And so when I first became program director, my then chair, Dr. Colleen Cook, who's amazing, said, you know, you need to not just be program director here, you need to get involved in education nationally, and you should check out the Society for Education and Anesthesia. And she said, I'm going to send you to the meeting, just like, you know, we heard, right? She said, I'm going to send you to the meeting. And I went to the first C meeting, and I've never missed one since. I've gone to every spring and fall meeting since, and it's been fabulous. And for me, it was, again, like Meredith said, I got there the first day. I just sat down at a table that happened to be labeled the Resident Education Committee. And that sounded made sense. I was a new program director. And I loved it. And there was just people all interested in the same stuff, as Meredith said. I kept going to the meetings, kept being a part of that, was asked to become chair of that committee, which I did. And I was chair for a few years, and then joined the editorial board of the C Journal, which is called the Journal of Education and Perioperative Medicine, which is a fabulous journal that is great both if you're interested in publishing education studies in anesthesia. It's a great journal for that. And we're always looking for people to be reviewers, so you can really get involved pretty easily with that. So became part of the editorial board there, which is great. And then 2 years ago, I decided I really wanted to give back to the organization more even than I had, and so ran for the board of directors and was elected. And so now I sit on the board of directors for the organization. I have felt all along the way that getting to connect with other anesthesia educators nationally has been a huge part of the joy I find in my career as an anesthesia educator and in my learning, because you go, you hear about things other people are doing, you get to build on that, you get to do workshops with people from around the country. Meredith and I, along with some other people, just did one at the spring meeting in Austin just a few weeks ago. And then you get to really interact with a group that comes to the workshop and build on that. So there's so many wonderful things about this that have become a major part of my career as an educator in anesthesia. Franklin, how about you?
Yeah, it's the themes and the story, I couldn't agree more. A lot of it is having that push from someone in your department that gets you in to see. But then once you're there, there's so many opportunities and so many almost little mini mentors there who want to pull you along. And that, I think that's my story is very similar to a lot of stories I just heard, which is kind of exciting to me because it feels like this community is a very consistent product of love and education. You know, it's kind of cool. So, I mean, in 2003, I was lucky because at University of Pittsburgh, we had several faculty who were involved with C. And every time I went to a C meeting, there were a lot of Pittsburgh people there, including our chair, John Williams, loved the society, came to it. Rita Patel, our vice chair of education, came to every meeting, was a Duke Award recipient several years ago. And so I started coming and then made connections and sat at the research committee table and worked on that for a couple of years. And Ivor Todd Cohen was like, you're going to be the chair. And I was like, I am. And did that for 6 years. It's like being a senator. Did that for 6 years. And then from there, as I was doing that, I remember Steve Kamadian and Michael Sanderson were like, you should be on the board. I'm like, that's for other people. That's for other leaders. Those are for the leaders of the world. They're like, what are you talking about? This is for people who grow into those roles. And I was like, okay. So I went for the board and hopped on the board. And then as I was on the board, I liked finances and I was getting my MBA. And so I wanted to get more involved with the finance committee and help revamp the finances for the society and got into the treasury role. And then from there, that's one of the tracks up into president-elect. So just for many, many years, just going every year, because just like you guys, it's fun. And every time I go, I feel like I'm learning, which is really so exciting and growing. And the opportunities exist for collaboration. And what's great about that is you're growing personally, but your career is growing because you're collaborating and you're making these products that can go onto your CV that get you promoted, whether it's workshops or giving a talk at the podium, just being on the committee, then a leadership role in the committee, all these things promote you. So there's so many great reasons to be part of the society and then to actually grow with the society. It's I think it's some great opportunities.
Yeah, fabulous. Well, thank you all for sharing your stories. And let's talk about education and anesthesia kind of in general. We all have decided this is a really important part of our careers, but let's talk about why one might do that. Let's say that we're talking to some medical students or some CA1s, intern CA1s, and they're thinking, okay, I'm trying to decide where I want to start gearing my career in anesthesia. I think I really like education. What would you say are some of the pros and cons of shaping your career around education and some of the ways you can take that? Of course, there are multiple. You could do education research and be a really kind of very serious researcher in education. You could be a program leader. You could be a someone who is really developing teaching skills and being involved in things like the workshop on teaching and helping others to be better teachers. So there's lots of ways to take it. How do people make those decisions? What would you recommend people think about? What might someone want to make sure they keep in mind if they're thinking about pursuing anesthesia education as part of their kind of career path? And Meredith, let's continue starting with you.
So I'd be curious to hear you guys' stories about, you know, staying in academia. I knew I wanted to, which I look back on and I think that was such a wonderful choice, but maybe a naive one, because it was the only one that I had known. You know, we go through medical school, and residency was at a big academic institution. And I knew that I loved my job. And I knew that I wanted to continue to mentor and teach residents. But I really didn't know what else that would entail. And I had this idea that it was going to have to be, you know, heavy duty research and grant writing. And I just thought, well, that's not what I'm passionate about. I really just want to be a mentor and someone who can make really good future anesthesiologists. And, but I had no idea that it would end up being, you know, growing into an APD role and becoming involved in education leadership. And I think that's maybe my takeaway and the advice that I would give to anyone who's thinking about staying in academics is that, you know, if you could build a career that isn't centered around research. And it all it takes is a passion for education and a passion for the next, you know, group of learners. And, you know, there are some, like, you know, many of you have masters in education and specifically looking at some of this. And I have none of that. And I look at you with amazement, and maybe one day I will. But it really was just a product of me having this great appreciation for Vanderbilt and my institution and wanting to give back in the same way that I received such fabulous mentorship.
Well, thanks, Meredith. And as you were kind of coming to that realization that you didn't have to do hardcore research to be fulfilled in your career in education, did C help with that? Were you able to kind of make connections with people who helped you get to that conclusion through C?
I mean, and I think that's one of the common themes. And one of the great, like you said, great part about C is you could essentially find someone to mirror your career off of in any track. You could, you know, find a mentor who looks exactly like you, who, you know, maybe isn't going to write the next R01 grant, but is really passionate. Like for me, you know, looking at young female residents who are thinking about starting, you know, their families, how do you start a mentorship program around that? Looking at, you know, people deciding on fellowships, what kind of, programs can we, tailor to, you know, help people choose. And so, I think that C helped open my eyes to all of the different possibilities, because you're in a room full of people who just care about education and just care about doing what's right by the next group of trainees.
Fabulous. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, folks. If you've ever been listening to a patient's heart and lungs in pre-op and wondering if there's some mild wheezing or a faint murmur, you are not alone. I used to struggle with this all the time until I got my echo. Honestly, listening through an echo is like night and day compared to a regular stethoscope. That's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and there's noise cancellation to cut out distractions. I can't emphasize enough how amazing it is when you can hear so clearly. And you can unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI, along with sound recording and sharing for earlier diagnosis as well. Echo is backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms. Those who use it are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. I can't tell you how much better I can hear hearts and lungs in every area that I work with my Echo. I trust Echo so much that I worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/ACRAC. Your purchase is HSA and FSA eligible and may qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently. If you don't, return it for a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/ACRAC for $50 off plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/ACCRAC.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
All right, and we're back. Bridget, how about you? What has, you know, been your growing into appreciation for how education is fulfilling for you? And what do you recommend for people getting started in terms of thinking about why they may or may not want to choose education as a focus for them?
So I sort of just ended up at the University of Rochester. I've always been sort of in the tag along wife. And so that was my first job. And, you know, I did the private practice thing. It wasn't anesthesia, but it was OB-GYN. And I, you know, wasn't ready to go back to the the business of medicine. Although, you know, maybe if I had an MBA like Franklin, I could manage that. Just an aside, like I've found my place in my career, and I like all of us on this podcast and all of us in C, we just love the energy of the education environment, and you know, seeing the moments and being there to nudge our learners along. Like there's just heartwarming energy that comes back to you. And so my husband left the University of Vermont last February and took a job at ECU, East Carolina University, you know, big academic center in Carolina. But their anesthesia department has nothing to do with the medical school. There's no residency. They don't do any teaching. And so he lives an hour and a half away from me, and I live here in Chapel Hill because that's how important academic medicine is to me. You know, it's not ideal, but it's okay. It's okay for now. And he understands how important that is to me. Advice for, you know, early career people or residents, in a way, to reiterate what Meredith said, I'm not a bench researcher. I don't write textbooks. I should probably write more manuscripts. Like, I have all these great ideas and I do a little bit of research, but I'm not disciplined enough to sit down and write the manuscript. So not only do I have an impact as an educator, but it's valued. And SEA has helped me see that. You don't need to have textbooks and research articles and funding to be valued in the academic arena. The other thing is, I did a qualitative research when I finished my master's, you know, you need a thesis project or whatever. And so I interviewed women who chose anesthesia, so residents or fourth year medical students, about their experience and how and why they came to choose anesthesia. And one of the themes that emerged was this safe, collaborative, supportive environment. As anesthesiologists, that's who we are, right? And so I think SEA is, that's who we are. We want to collaborate. We care about DEI. We'll say it on a podcast, right, Franklin? And
we do.
We're just like, we want to serve. Like, we want to turn around and pull that next person up with us. And so that, you know, that brings me joy and brings me energy. And so C helped me see that, and C helps me to continue to pursue those passions.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And I think that one of the things that's really key is that while there was a time, and there's still maybe some of this, where it might be, and certainly used to be, harder to get promoted as an educator than as, let's say, a bench researcher. I mean, I think that was very clear. But we are starting to see that change. There are more and more institutions that now have educator tracks that you can get promoted on. And in addition to that, one of the, among many great things that I've found about C is that even if you didn't, I think a lot of people think, oh, I just don't know how to do research, I couldn't do it. But maybe you go to C and you meet some people who have done some education research, gotten it published in JEPM, the C journal, or somewhere else. And they you talk to them and you realize, oh, they're just like me. They don't know anything that I don't know. And yet they were able to do it, right? They got some help from someone or a mentor, or they're willing to help me. And you really can do this. I remember going to a workshop that Jeff Berger and some folks put on, Jeff Berger being one of the editors-in-chief of the JEPM journal, about how to be a peer reviewer, how to do peer review for a journal. And I had never done peer review before. I was a brand new faculty member, and I thought that was so useful. And then I said, sure, I'll, now that I know, I would not have signed up to do it because I didn't know what I was doing. And then after that workshop, I said, oh, okay, like I'll do some of these peer reviews. And that, and then I later, you know, did enough of them and got good enough and became more involved with the journal, and then became an associate editor of the journal. So that's a path that I had no prior training for. Anyone could walk that path. It's just a matter of getting that help, and C provides a lot of that, which is fabulous. Franklin, how about you? What would you add to this story?
Wait, before Franklin answers, I'm going to just tag on to what Jed just said in response to sort of Meredith saying, oh, and you all have these extra letters after your name. You don't need the extra letters after your name to do any of that. Right, Jed?
Totally yeah. Agree. No. I accidentally have them, right? I did the master's in education before medical school. Yeah. You know, there's zero that I know that you don't know, Meredith. It is 100%. You're doing exactly what you should be doing, and don't need the letters. Yeah, I agree. Franklin, how about you?
I would say MBA doesn't have much to do with education. Mm-hmm. I just can balance my checkbook and make good investments. Although today nothing works. Anyway, that's a different podcast. So the theme though is growth. And I think what's really cool is the original question was about advice to people who were thinking about education, whether they're med students or residents or fellows who think about it. What is funny though is when I interview people for our fellowship or the residency, most of the fellowship, and when I talk to folks about what they want to do with their career, a lot of people say, I want to teach. I'm always like, but what does that mean? And I think part of it is helping them realize there's a menu out there. And on this menu is exactly what both Meredith and Bridget and Jed, you guys have talked about. All those little options is this research. And research does not have to be bench research. I mean, it could be a super simple question that you thought about with your associate PD or a fellow. And you're like, oh, let's look into that. And you put it together. And now you've answered a educational question. So it could be research. It could be, do you want to be more administratively involved with education? Meaning, do you want to develop, whether it's curriculum, or be involved with some of the ACGME pieces that exist there? Or do you want to be involved in simulation? Do you want to be someone who puts together PBLD? What does it really look like? Because there's so many opportunities that are out there, including leadership. I would argue leadership, how we train and teach our future leaders, is such an essential component of education. Because, I mean, JFK said this, he said, without learning, there's no leadership. So a continuous learning process is critical in developing our future leaders. So all that stuff is available to see, and you get to see it when you come to the meetings. You get to sit at the committee meetings or realize, oh, there's a lot of committees here, and they're all kind of starting to answer those questions and provide those resources. So I think a lot of it for the trainees is, great, you want to be a teacher. Let's talk about that. What is, and part of it, I think actually Nadia Hernandez, I think, said this on her panel at C in Austin at the meeting last month or a few weeks ago. She said, find your burning platform. Find that thing, that question that you feel like you have to answer. I would say that's true for any part of education. Find that part of education that feels like your burning platform, because then you'll be in flow and you'll find yourself in a space that's enjoyable. And then you'll meet those other people around you who also enjoy that. And if you don't have it at your institution, you can come to C, because C is going to have some people there who will have that similar branding platform who will want to collaborate.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So as we think about progressing in our careers, and you can either talk about your own thoughts if you're comfortable sharing that, or just in general, when you think about how does progression, whether that means going from being an APD to a PD, from a division chief to a chair, from a program director to a DIO, you know, whatever the progression is in your mind, you know, how we've all, whether we've done it ourselves or whether we've seen people do it, we've seen this happen. How does C help with that, do you think, either whether you've experienced it or you've seen it happen? Franklin, you've probably seen more than the rest of us in terms of people going through C. What do you think?
It to me, what's fascinating is my personal growth. And as I've watched myself evolve over 20 years, literally 22 years. And it's fascinating, because I think part of the advice I would also give to trainees as far as is not just find your burning platform, but also always keep asking yourself, what do you want to be? Not what do you want to become, but what do you want to be at the heart of that? Because then you start to realize, oh, there's some roles or some positions or some activities I really could engage that I never thought of engaging before. And C was very much that model for me. I remember joining in 2003 and thinking, great meeting, learning lots. I'm going to be teaching in the OR so much better. Did the teaching workshop, loved it. Came back, felt like, okay, I'm an APD. And I thought, I'll become a program director. And then 2006, I became a program director. And I thought, that's it, I've arrived. And then you realize there's actually more, if you want it. And C really helped with that, because as I moved up the ranks through C, and even like chairing the committee of research, I remember thinking, really? I've been on this committee and helping out and doing stuff. You want me to chair it? But then to do that for 6 years and feel like, oh, I can do this actually. And then to sit on the board and you realize that leadership pathway, but to have people support you and coach you. So much of this is having that, those people as the primary resource to help you see that there's actually more. and to help you realize you can grow into those roles. That, I think, is what's so critical. And so C is really, for me, it's actually been kind of an escalator that's helped me not just with C, but also just other parts of my life. I mean, thinking about being a division chief. I mean, that was kind of something that is, I've grown into that role, but that was not part of my plan 10, 15 years ago. But I feel like all those things come together. So growth, again, is one of those themes I would say C can really help with. But if you think about this, it's very Carol Dweck. It's very growth mindset where you realize, oh, I don't have the skill set to do that. But Carol Dweck would say, you don't have those skill sets yet.
Yeah, such great points. And I think that one of the things that is so great about C is that you meet, there's so many people interested in education who you're going to meet, and they're going to be at all different stages. And so if you want to know, do I want to go to the next level? I mean, there are plenty of people who they're APDs, they think they want to be a PD, then they get to know the role by talking to PD, and they think, actually, forget that, that's not what I want. Or you think that's absolutely what I want, and then you have PDs who can help you figure out how did they do it, how did they make that transition, and what did they keep in mind? I remember very distinctly, and I'm so grateful to him, Jeff Berger, again, wonderful friend and mentor, who I'd reached out to because he had been a program director for a long time. This is when I knew I was going to be becoming program director, but before I officially became it. And he was just down, I'm in Baltimore, he's down in DC, and at the time he was the DIO. But he said, come on down, just come spend a day with me. And so I couldn't believe it. I don't know how he made the time, but we spent the day and he talked to me about being a program director, but I also got to see kind of what he was doing as a DIO. And it was really a great opportunity to be able to see what would this next step be like. Now, at the time, I wasn't even a program director, so I certainly wasn't thinking about the next step. But now, even 10 years later, I remember that experience. And I think to myself, oh, okay, that was a neat window into this different role. And would I ever want that role someday? So the connections you make with people who are going to be at all different stages. And I mean, there are chairs, there are vice chairs, there are program directors, there are DIOs, all these people are coming to see. And so you really get to pick their brain. And I think that's a really rich opportunity. Bridget, Meredith, anything you want to add there?
I'm going to tag on to what Franklin was saying about, you think, oh, I don't have this skill set. There's no way I could do that. And you will build those skill sets. And I will say the collaborative nature of C helps all of us with that imposter syndrome, right? Like you show up and you have coffee and you realize, oh, you're a program director. Oh, you did that research. I could do that. Or you're on the research committee and you're reading all these abstracts thinking, oh, that was a really interesting question. Look how simply they answered that. I could do that here. I could encourage fellow faculty to do that research here. So I think that has really helped me with my own personal growth. And I think if I didn't have my C colleagues, friends, supporters, leaving my titles in Vermont and coming here just to be a clinician educator would be more uncomfortable than it is. Like I know I have some neat ideas. I have some really great colleagues, and I will grow my career again here. And I'm very comfortable with, I don't know what the script is, and life isn't a script. Your professional career is not a script. And I think that's something else I would tell junior faculty and medical students and residents. Be comfortable with a little bit of unknown and be brave to sort of make a jump here or there. It all works out the way it's meant to be. And life's about the journey, not the destination, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you make such a good point, which is also that, you may decide that you're perfectly happy being an anesthesiologist who teaches residents and fellows or whatever you're doing. And you may not want to be a PD or a vice chair or a chair or a division chief or a DIO. And that's okay. And again, through C, I think what you find are people who have made that choice and are very happy. And so you can feel in a world where I think we're all pushed to think what's next, what's next, what's next. I think having people who are showing you, actually, that's not the only option is really helpful. And you can get that through C too.
Well said. I was just thinking, I think C has people have seen stuff in me that I haven't been able to see for myself. And they have been able to say, like you said, you can do this. Advocate for yourself. Your CV is ready for you to go up for a promotion. Start putting that in, you know, people's ear. You are ready to move from assistant to associate PD. This is how I made that transition. You know, make your, if someone told me to make the job description, show that you are already doing that job, advocate for yourself. And so I think that that's been, you know, a nice, pleasant push. But again, Jen, to your point, and I was reflecting on this when I was thinking about the podcast and why we do what we do. It really, a lot is just for the love of the game and for, you know, giving a man a fish versus teaching a man to fish and doing something that's kind of bigger than yourself. And even without, you know, being in education leadership, I think I would go and stay in academics just for that.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I'd like to hear from each of you just one thing, and I'm sure there are many, I have many, but if you had to pick one thing that you could go back and if you could tell your brand new attending self, you just finished residency, what would you say, if given one piece of advice to yourself back when you were just finishing training and getting into this job of being an educator in anesthesia? Franklin, you have to think back the farthest, so maybe we'll give you time. We'll start with Meredith, who's got the...
That's such a lovely way to say that I'm old. Thank you, Jed. So my pre-retirement self, what am I...
That's right.
I think, you know, it is funny. I would actually... it's funny. When I think back of the two concepts that have really shaped how I think about education in many ways, and... Because there were concepts that actually helped me grow. One is, again, that Carol Dweck's concept of growth mindset, which there are some nuances to it, of course, but also the whole concept of what Amy Edmondson did with psychological safety. Those two pieces, but the growth mindset piece is when you are challenged, and you will be challenged, whether it's clinical work, educational work, academia, whatever it's going to be, personal life, you are more than you realize. And you can grow skill sets that you don't even know exist, that and actually develop areas of your life that you're not even sure are there. That, I think, is so key, because for many people, it's, Bridget, I think you mentioned that scripted, that concept of, I think a lot of people, we want certainty. The stock market surely wants certainty, but people want it too. People want certainty in their lives. And part of it is we script our lives in some ways. I'll do this residency, I'll do this fellowship, then I'll do this and I'll be a teacher. And the answer is there may be a lot more for you out there. And to be open to growth, because it will happen. With intentional work and effort, it will happen. And that to me is really, really exciting. It kind of, it's like having a coach earlier on, a coach who kind of gets you to where you want to be. That becomes, I think, really critical. But also, I think as an educator, the whole continuously infusing that state of psych safety is what I think is what's been so key in education, particularly today, where, I mean, I know we've joked around a little about DEI, but in all seriousness, when those things get weaponized and now we're creating environments that are a little scary for people, creating this environment where people feel like they can take interpersonal risk becomes so critical. That concept becomes so critical in every area of healthcare, whether it's clinical work, patient care, or education.
Yep, fabulous. Thank you. Bridget, how about you? Looking back, brand new you, what would you tell yourself?
Brand new me as an anesthesia attending. I had a mentor when I first took my first job as an anesthesiologist. My kids were very little. I had a newborn, a six-year-old, a three-year-old, and she said, your first job, she said, just be 60%. Just from the start. It's really hard to cut back, but just tell them I'm 60%. And I did, and my, you know, new chair said, okay, fine. But probably for the first 5, 8, maybe 10 years, I felt like I wasn't giving enough. There was like this guilt when I was home with the kids or whatever. And so now there's like, you know, I think the older we get, we're like, whatever, I'm doing enough. But I wish I felt back then like I was doing enough and I was enough. So the advice I would give was, whatever you're doing, you are doing enough. If that's what you can give, then yes, you're doing it.
Yeah, so
important. And be comfortable in that space.
So important. I say it to the residents all the time. Give yourself some grace, you know, especially our new moms who are trying to be a mom. They're trying to be a partner. They're trying to be a resident all at the same time. Three full-time jobs. And, you know, I always tell them, I know you're not going to feel like you're doing any one of them well enough. But first of all, you are. And second of all, give yourself some grace, right? You're doing three full-time jobs. And that's so, so key. Meredith, how about you?
Oh, gosh, I had so many lessons. I actually think someone told me, and I think this is really true, that you'll learn more in the first 5 years as an attending than you did as a trainee. And I feel that way. And I feel like I'm just now reaching steady state in terms of my clinical practice. And that's not, I learn something every single day. And whether it's, you know, self-taught or my residents bring something to me or, you know, the surgeons and dialogue, we stumble onto something. But I think to Franklin's point, embracing that growth and realizing that it's not a failure. It's just, you know, becoming who you are as an attending.
Yeah, absolutely. Such a great point. And I always tell our graduating residents who are inevitably, right, feel like, wait, I don't know it all yet. I say, of course you don't. You're going to learn so much more. I guess I would say among many things that I would say go get yourself some great mentors. And what I mean is that, you know, some of the most significant mentors in my life have not been people who were assigned to me as like an assigned mentor. And they weren't people who, you know, kind of came looking for me, but they were people who I learned over time. And I wish I had started it earlier, but I learned that you have to go get them. And that there's plenty of people out there who would love to be a mentor to you, but you know, how would they know? I mean, you know, but go and say, I tell the residents, and I would recommend this to anybody, is, you know, if you have a day in the OR, you work with an attending and you think, that was great, I really enjoyed working that person, don't let it go. Email them and say, hey, I really enjoyed working with you. You know, I would love to talk some more. I'd love to get your, you know, hear about your career. I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of what I'm thinking. Could I come by your office? Could we grab coffee? And people are so reluctant to do it, right? It's almost like how reluctant you are to like ask someone out on a date, or at least back when people used to ask people out on dates, right? There's like, they're afraid. What? And I say to them, what are you afraid of? You know, they're not going to say no, right? It's like it's a guarantee that they'll be happy to do it. And from those kind of interactions, you can end up developing really significant mentorships that then later become friendships and lifelong, you know, really wonderful relationships. So I think don't be afraid. Go advocate for your own learning and growth by going and asking people, hey, would you be my mentor? And I think you'll really find you'll get some great people that way. All right. Well, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. But before we do, actually, I want to just make sure we'll put it in the show notes. But for those who have listened to this and think, hey, I want to check out C. And again, you can be anyone in any level of any job. If you're interested in anesthesia education, you can join and come and be at a C meeting. And so if you want to, I would recommend going to the website, which we'll put in the show notes. It's seahq.org, and check it out. And you can get all the information there. We'll put the links in the show notes. All right, let's talk about random recommendations, something fun we'd recommend that the audience check out. Meredith, let's start with you.
I thought you'd never ask it. I thought about this for a long time. So I was between two books, but I decided on Midnight Library by Matt Haig. I don't know if you guys have read it, any Bridget or Franklin, but it reminds me, Bridget, it kind of reminds me of what you said, and I don't want to give anything away, but it's about a woman who gets to imagine different versions of her life. And essentially, like, the moral is you are doing enough. And no regrets, live in the moment. So highly recommend.
Great book. I'll second that. Yeah. Bridget, how about you?
I know it's supposed to be non-medicine, but it's a historical fiction. It's called The Surgeon's Daughter by Audrey Blake. And it's set back in the mid 1800s. And she is a woman who lives in London, who's apprenticed to a surgeon. But then she's found out, and you can't be a woman who's a surgeon in London. So they send her to Italy, to Bologna, which I think is the oldest academic institution in the world. And it's certainly the oldest medical school. And so she's an apprentice there, but it's certainly not much easier being a woman there. And kind of a little bit of a tie to anesthesia and a little bit OB anesthesia. Back then, they did everything. So she does, you know, some C-section. She finds herself an older female mentor. She's doing ether back when ether was sort of new. And they're, you know, the patients and the sort of the stories of being a medical student and apprentice. And just a fun read. I love historical fiction.
Fabulous. Franklin, how about you?
I'm going to go in a slightly different direction. I am going to recommend Chocolate Company. Ooh. And I'm going to recommend a podcast. But you and I have talked about this, Deb, but La Maison du Chocolat, if you want some fabulous chocolate, La Maison du Chocolat is great. It'll ship to your house. It's a little expensive, though. But you know, when I do have some downtime, a guilty pleasure is I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, but the Ezra Klein Show I've been listening to lately. And part of it's the guests that he's had on have been so good. I mean, recently he had an economist who's an economist and anthropologist talking about what's going on economically, but also politically, and kind of how they overlap. Just really fascinating stuff. His guests are great. So it's really been, when I do some downtime, that is just a great little cognitive guilty pleasure.
Fabulous. Yes, love it. And among many wonderful things about C, we talked about, right, you get together with these people, you bounce ideas off each other, both about anesthesia education and about anything. And so at the most recent C meeting, we were out to dinner, a group of us, and we were talking, and we were decided to talk about books, and we were recommending different books. And I got a fabulous recommendation from Meredith, and it is a book called The Art of Racing in the Rain by Garth Stein. And I read it, and it was fabulous. It is an easy, relatively short read. You can read it quickly. It is hard kind of to describe what it's about. I would say it's about life and overcoming adversity and family and love, all told through the eyes of a dog, which is a really neat, unusual way to tell a book, but so well done. And I really loved it and would highly recommend it. All right. Thank you all. This has been such a great time. Love the conversation, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks,
Jen. Hey, folks, before you go, really cool thing I think you should think about donating to. I get no money from this at all, but there's a couple of CRNA students who have developed a set of patent-pending 3D printed video laryngoscope blades and airway tools that are designed to help improve airway safety in low-resource settings. They're focusing on Cameroon, where a lack of airway equipment has resulted in preventable patient harm. They're fundraising to continue production and deliver this equipment, as well as train local providers on sustainable use of this equipment. So they have a website you can check out and a donation link. I'm going to put it in the show notes. Think about donating. This is a really great cause, and they're doing great work. Thanks so much. All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan is our social media manager. And William Mao is our production assistant. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.